Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
Welcome to the Leader's Toolbox on Firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway, and I have a very special guest with me today, John Politis. He is the chief of the Colony EMS in upstate New York, where he's served for 21 years, and he's also been a volunteer firefighter for the Verdoy Fire Department for about 30 years. And we are at the Wisconsin EMS Expo in Milwaukee, and John did a class here called Supervisors Boot Camp, and it caught my attention, and I had dinner with John last night, and we talked some about his course, and I thought it was intriguing and a very interesting concept of the Supervisors Boot Camp, so we're going to do a podcast show. John, welcome to the Leader's Toolbox.
Thanks a lot, Rich. I'm glad to be here.
Well, what's the Supervisor's Toolbox all about, John? What was the creation for it? What was your motivation to do this?
I've been involved in emergency services for a long time. I've served in both career and volunteer fire departments, and had an opportunity to serve in two state EMS offices, and I was a paramedic training program coordinator, and was the training coordinator for New York State EMS, and then for the last 21 years, I've been the chief of a municipal EMS service. That's a combination organization, and over the 30 some odd years that I've been doing this, I've seen an awful lot of really good people enter emergency services and get into supervisory positions and leadership positions, and just for a whole variety of reasons. Just not survive, become really dissatisfied, really unhappy, or have something happen to them which caused their early departure from service. There are really a lot of excellent people in emergency services, and there are some common themes. Sometimes it's that a person doesn't know how to work cooperatively with a board, whether it's a board of fire commissioners or whether it's a board of directors or what have you. In other cases, there is some significant ethical lapse or issue in the workplace, or it can be a variety of things. And as a manager, supervisor, officer, we have great clinical training. We've trained people well to be good EMTs and paramedics and firefighters. Then you can go to graduate school or get a bachelor's degree in management, things. But at the end of the day, nobody really teaches you about the critical survival skills. When do you write a letter versus make a phone call? How do you work with a board? How do you need to get your hands around basic leadership and working with your people? And I know, you're a real student of servant leadership, that your job really is to be there to help serve the people that you work with. And the program really is about that. It typically is a 2-day program. We crammed it into 1 day here in Wisconsin, but it's a typically 2-day program. It starts off with a presentation that typically takes a morning about going through a buddy to boss transition. What's the difference between being somebody's friend and then making the transition to being their boss, and how much different that is. And it's often hard to really understand a job until you have to do it. We do a whole bunch of management case studies, which are classical things that happen in the workplace, everything from time and attendance issues to, quality improvement issues and how you would address those and deal with them. We then get into a presentation which is always very lively, about ethical considerations and ethical boundaries. Then there's another presentation that deals with diagnosing performance issues. Literally, there were millions of dollars spent on training for things that cannot be affected by training. Most industries have figured out that we need to hire tough and train easy. Southwest Airlines doesn't hire flight attendants and train them to be funny when they do their funny safety briefing. They hire people with the right personality, and there's a lot that can be learned from different industries. We get into the performance, analyzing performance issues, what can be affected by training, what can't. We then evolve into another, and there's more case studies, evolve into more sessions that deal with coaching, counseling, corrective action, and discipline, which as somebody that I know we all admire a great deal in emergency services, and I believe has made an incredible contribution to us, is Gordon Graham, who I know we've all heard speak and admire. In his matrix of risk management, he talks about low frequency, high risk things, and a lot of the disciplinary and personnel things that we deal with very much are, they don't happen frequently, but they're very high risk when they do happen. And a smart supervisor manager needs to rely on the experts that are around them and take their time, because there is usually discretionary time. And the sad reality of that is that when you do enough coaching, counseling, and corrective action, people will not be happy with you. You will make some enemies. And sometimes the enemies that you make are people who are happy with you. They're happy with you because you've done the right thing, but they just don't agree with you. And that's also a reality of stepping up into a supervisory job. And we typically wrap up with some of the contemporary issues in emergency services and give people an opportunity to talk about that in more case studies, which are thought-provoking, to try and get the group to get their hands around some of the nuts and bolts issues that they would deal with. In the program, we don't get into doing things about time management. We don't get into talking about how to run a meeting, how to set up a budget, how to spec, apparatus and things like that. The bottom line is, as a firefighter, firefighters go through things like firefighter safety and survival training. Great programs. And I think it's done an awful lot to help save the lives of firefighters and EMTs across the country. But there really isn't anything out there that I would liken to being a safety and survival program for people who are stepping into this dangerous domain of supervision, whether that's being a company officer, as a lieutenant or captain, stepping up to be battalion chief, or whether you're being elected in your volunteer fire company to be a lieutenant, captain, or officer, or whether you're an EMS supervisor. There's a tremendous amount of crossover between fire and EMS, and that's really what the program is about.
That's a very interesting concept, because it maybe cuts out some of the fluff that you might see in some of the canned programs, and focuses just 2 days on what you say is the down and dirty, the things you're going to need to know to when you get that first promotion to be a supervisor. What are some of the risks that are associated with this move into supervision? If somebody goes from being a line and fire or EMS person into supervision, it seems kind of a risky proposition. What are some of those concerns that they might have, and how could they overcome them?
Well, it's a difficult spot to be in, and I think every one of us who's done something, whether volunteer career, really the issues are pretty much the same. Different twists on them, but when you make that transition from being their buddy, that you're their coworker, people are very often congratulatory to you to say, God, great job. You took this position as a supervisor, company officer, what have you. And you get a bit of a honeymoon period as you go into those positions. But you started off being their buddy, being your coworker, being someone that really didn't have to be have the responsibility. And I have to give a plug for someone who I also admire a great deal and has given me permission to use some of his cartoons in my talk. But there's a firefighter who his name is Paul Combs, who's an editorial cartoonist, which I think Paul really captures the essence of many of the issues in the fire service. And once you get that gold badge, whether it's the gold badge of an EMS supervisor or gold badge of a fire officer, what comes with that is a set of responsibilities that are now placed on you that were different than when you were somebody's buddy. And now, once you step into that, it is folly to think that your life has not changed. you know, you as an officer, as a company officer, as a supervisor, are really expected to be the rock. You're expected to be the strong, steady, stable influence in whatever your work environment is. And everybody's on boss watch. Everybody watches what you do as a boss at any level. They watch what you do as a supervisor. They watch what you do as a captain. They watch what you do as a battalion chief. They watch what you do as a chief officer. And everybody's watching what the boss does. And the thing that's difficult about it is a guy who's my deputy chief, who I admire a great deal, and I've learned a tremendous amount from him. And I actually had him as one of my paramedic students almost 30 years ago. His name's Peter Barry. And I never forget a little bit of wisdom he laid on me. He said, you know, John, you never really understand a job until you have to do it. And I think everybody who's ever done this has that bit of wisdom. And really what he was referring to me was simply that it's really easy when you're a captain to look at your battalion chief or what have you or your chief and say, I could do that job better than you can. And in fact, everyone thinks they can do the job better than you can. And another hackneyed thing in the fire service is the only good chief is the last one and the next one. The one that's there right now is no good, but nobody's really had to walk a mile in your shoes. You know, but the same thing can be said for that new lieutenant, new EMS supervisor, new EMS lieutenant, or whatever the position may be. People generally don't understand the responsibilities that come along with this, and you're really walking into something which is really different. And I think lots of times people don't realize that their friendships are just not going to be the same as they were before. And it's not like you're going to jettison your friends, but you go out to do things socially with people because we make great friends in emergency services. We make lifelong friends, but it becomes difficult because people often bring up work and they're just simply things that you really shouldn't be talking about. You know, there are human resources issues, and there are many things that are on the table. It's not like you're trying to hide them from anybody or want to hide them, but there are just many things that you really shouldn't be talking about because it's not appropriate. And another thing that's difficult is people change how they communicate with you. There's a much maligned management book written by Machiavelli. In his book, Machiavelli the Prince, he wrote his book, hundreds of years ago, as a present of riches to his king or his rulers, but a collection of information about how rulers stayed in power over time. And one of the things that he says in his book is, first, shun the flatterers. What he refers to is that people who are coming into your office or coming to you flattering you and pumping sunshine up your butt all the time are telling you what you want to hear, and it's very flattering. But you know, to really be effective, you have to hear things that you need to hear. And when you become in that leadership position, I experience this all the time. I'm very often the last to know anything. People come in and go, Chief, you didn't know that? I'm like, search me. I had no idea. As Rodney Dangerfield would say, who knew?
Yeah.
just had no idea. And people simply change how they communicate with you. And it can be a pretty lonely place. You're now in a supervisory position, and you are now stuck between the people that you admire and you respect because you came from them. You came from being a frontline worker, and you want to do right by them. And at the same time, there is upper management or your council or your administration, and everyone is feeling a little stuck in the middle. And it's a lot different than being a front-end worker. One of the other things that's difficult about it is that being a leader and being in a manager position is all about instant gratification. You know, we go out in the field and we do things that, you know, I like to joke because one of the things, you know, I'm a full-time EMS chief, and I've always loved the fire service ever since my dad took me to fire drills as a little kid, you know. I remember the tremble of that 1956 Seagraves on the apparatus floor and the smell of the canvas hose to this day. I like to go out, and I like to break stuff and spray water. there's nothing like taking the irons and breaching a door, you know. Good instant gratification while we got in that door. Come back from the call, we got great camaraderie, things are good. When you're going to the office, all of a sudden now you're dealing with having to worry about long-term capital plans. You're having to deal with human resources issues. You're having to deal with overtime reports. You're having to deal with things that take forever. Something as simple as trying to get apparatus, whether it be ambulances or fire trucks or life packs or hydraulic rescue tools, is a two-year budgeting, year budgeting. And once you get the money in the budget, then you got to go and you got to spec it, and you got to deal with the bidding process. And by the time the apparatus actually, the equipment actually shows up, everybody's like, "Oh, this is terrible. We should have gotten this." And it's even when you might get some delayed gratification at the end of the day, you walk away from it going, "What just happened here?" And sometimes it can be a really difficult spot to be in. And I think people who walk into a management position need to walk in with some kind of open eyes. I firmly believe that. And the reason that we all do this crazy thing, we step up, is because it's really an opportunity to make a difference on a bigger scale. And I think that's a really important part of why we do what we do, that we actually can make a difference to people.
You said they go through this honeymoon period where people are going to be congratulatory and initially supportive. Sometimes you're competing against other candidates and only one gets the job, and that might be you. And those others who don't get the job aren't always so congratulatory. In other words, they might be angry or jealous or vindictive or believe in their heart that they should have had it instead of you. And they're going to do everything they can to try to prove that they were the better candidate. And it can kind of create some issues. You got some advice as to how a newly promoted officer could deal with that, that person who is just not handling well the news that you got the job and they didn't?
Well, that's a tough one. The first person I worked for in local government was a man who embodied everything that I could ever imagine as being a good and a public official. And I'll drop his name. His name is Fred Field, and he served many years in the state legislature, state assembly in New York. We were listening to the kids run down the hallway.
We're at the Hilton, and if you can't hear that on the podcast, there's a gaggle of kids running down the hallway, probably on their way to the swimming pool. God bless them.
And early on, when I was hired to consolidate what were a bunch of rescue squads in the community into a single municipal EMS service, and I thought I'd done many difficult things so far at that point in my career, and I really never so badly underestimated a task in my life. I went through some difficult times. One of the services was very adversarial to the process, they were very frustrating. And I remember having a conversation with Fred in his office one day, and he laid on me this gem. He said that no matter what, I always take the high road. That if I can't succeed at taking the high road, then I just don't want to do the job. I don't want to do it. And what he was referring to is that no matter what, didn't matter who walked into his office, whether it was a Republican, Democrat, it wasn't a partisan thing. Fred, tried to get to the bottom of what is the right thing to do here, in not try and slug it up, but simply to do the right thing. And over and over again, in every situation in my life, his words have resounded with me about taking the high road. And it's really difficult that many people will be disappointed and frustrated over not getting a position. And where I work with exceptional people who I believe are the best of the best, many of whom I trained as paramedics 30 years ago. Now I look at them and say, you guys are better paramedics than I ever thought of being. I just get out of their way because they're so good. And when it comes to promotional things, it comes down to having to split hairs between one or the other. It would take the wisdom of Solomon to decide who to pick. And it's very frustrating for me as a leader, and of course the interview panels and everyone else involved in the process. But, you know, if you're working with somebody who's a coworker who cannot appreciate, you know, that you were selected over them, doesn't mean that the person not selected wasn't good or appropriate. It was simply the decision went a different direction. But I think the important thing is if you were the person who's selected and you're having some adversity, and I think it's critical for you to take the high road and not get involved in slinging mud and keep skid chains on your tongue. We kind of joke in this class. I have a picture of an X-ray of a Homer Simpson brain with a little brain and a mouth, and you need to work on your brain-mouth disconnect. Just because it's in your head doesn't mean you have to say it. And you know, my wife reminds me of that all the time. Just because it's in your mouth, you don't have to say it. I think it could be a guy thing that sometimes we can all become a little too testosterone poisoned and say things. And lots of times, and we've all been guilty of it, myself included, have said things that I wish I had never said because sometimes our words really hurt. And, you know, people will remember a long time around around the table what you've said or how you've done things. And at the end of the day, people will remember, and they do remember, if you've treated people fairly and you've treated them with respect. Those people who are going to take pot shots at you and are going to be really critical of you, eventually they will isolate themselves. And if you simply take the high road and don't engage, then you will survive in the long run. There's also that old adage of never wrestle with a pig. The pig likes it, and you just both get dirty. Or never argue with an idiot, because pretty soon the audience can't tell the difference, you know, who the idiot is. So, you know, I know that those are cliches, and, you know, I hate to do management by cliche. None of us do, but the words that have always resounded with me. And again, all of us, I know you have to, Rich, work with and for some remarkable people. People I work with every day, I learn a lot from. And I like to listen to them because people in our younger generations, I learn a lot from them. Learn a lot from my officers. I learn a lot from the administration I work with in our town. Learn a lot from people in the fire service. And, you know, the sad irony of this is that, you know, I'm like many people in the fire service, you know, probably within the next 10 years, I'll be retiring from emergency services. And hopefully we'll be dragging a little fire truck toy around with me on some beach someplace. But by the time you learn all of this, it's about time to move on to do something else, I guess. But the Fred Field wisdom for me of taking the high road, doing the right thing, it has always been really good advice. And advice from a man who was highly successful in public service and is revered in our area for the type of leader that he was.
Well, I think it's anytime you come across somebody who's looking for a fight, when you're in a position of leadership, the best advice is what you said, is take the high road. Don't give them the fight back. You know, if somebody's looking for a fight, find a way to defuse the situation, even if you got to walk away from it. When a bully is looking to fight and you engage them in the fight, like you said, you know, who's the idiot in the room, you may beat them at the fight, the verbal fight in front of other people who are witnessing it, but you suffer when you beat up that person in the presence of an audience. And, you know, the high road advice is great advice. John, some of the people who get promoted in fire and EMS face some pretty big people management challenges. What are some of those what are some of the key challenges that you see that these supervisors face when they get promoted?
Well, one of them is dealing with personalities. And I have to tell you that I was lucky enough to I'd always wanted to get my master's degree, and I was fortunate enough to get into a program run by Marist College in New York State. And it was a off-campus program run at the New York State Police Academy, and one of our professors was doing the course on human resource management, did a written MMPI test, you know, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Index test for all of us in class, to try and give us a glimpse into our own personalities, and I thought that was very useful. And as part of it, he took us through an exercise. His name is Bob Rose, and he took us through this exercise that I do in the boot camp class, which is very eye-opening when it comes to personality. I ask everybody in the room, I say to them, You know, tonight I'm going to have a party. I'm going to give a party tonight. Those of you who would come to my party without qualification, I want you to go to the back of the room. And those of you who are thinking to yourselves, well, I don't know, what kind of beer is he going to serve? Is anybody going to be there? I'm not really sure. I don't have clothes to wear. I don't know. I think I have to straighten my sock drawer tonight. Anybody who has any qualifications, you guys go to the front of the room. And immediately by doing that, what you do is you separate people into two different groups, one that has extroverted tendencies and one that has introverted tendencies. And those are people, the people who are the introverted people. It doesn't mean that they're introverts, like they're going to sit in the room all by themselves and do nothing all the time, but just that they are a little bit more introverted and often a bit more introspective about things. The next question I ask is, and that's essential, because when you're doing a function in an organization, paid or volunteered, EMS or fire, there will be people who simply don't show up to social functions and don't want to engage. And it doesn't necessarily have anything to do with the fact that they don't like you. It has to do with the fact that they very often show some introverted tendencies and they may not feel comfortable. And probably the most famous person who would fall into that category is Johnny Carson. If you've ever read or listened to anything about Johnny Carson, when he was on stage, the master interviewer, incredible personality, incredible mind, incredible man. But when he would go off stage, he was a very introverted, very private person. But when he was out in public, you know, he was in command of the situation. And I also know that about myself, that I have those introverted tendencies, that if I'm in command of a situation, meaning I'm up teaching a class, I get up and I do well. But people are often very surprised at me personally that, you know, I have some of those introverted tendencies. It puts me in stark terror to be going through a receiving line, for example, and having to remember everyone's name, and I have anxiety about that. Well, there's a lot of people like that. Then what I do is those two groups, I then say, okay, well, you know, in this boot camp, we have a project due. And the project is going to be due in 2 weeks. And it's going to be a 10-page paper on corrective action. And I ask, okay, those of you in the front of the room, you know, who are the folks who were the you know, introverts, I say, okay, well, those of you who would start working on that project right away, you go to one side. Those of you who would wait until the last minute till the spirit moved you, you go to the other side. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I do the same thing with the extroverts at the back of the room. Then I ask another question within those groups, and I ask some people to come to the center. And the question is, I would like you to, those of you who would tell me, give me directions by something like this. Okay, how do I get to Walmart? Well, you go out, you go exactly 1/10 of a mile, you make a left turn at the traffic signal, you go 2/10 of a mile, you take a right-hand turn, you drive 3.2 miles, and then you'll see the exit, and then it gives you directions that are very specific in terms of lists, orders, etc. You come to the center, and you stand over here. And then those of you who are would give directions like, well, you know, you kind of go down there, you know, you see the bar that says Miller Time on it. Well, you're going to go there, and you're going to make a right-hand turn. You're going to drive down a couple of miles until you see a big red house on the left, and you're going to turn there. And then you're going to drive down a ways. You're going to see another bar, and you're going to see some other sort of turn. Well, that's a person who's very visual. People who give you directions such as go 3.2 miles, et cetera, those people are folks who like lists, orders, numbers. And the people, and very often, amazingly, those same people are also the ones that, if they were the almost always the ones that would work on a project immediately. The people on the other side of the room are people who would give you visual directions or would wait till the very last minute. Those are people who typically what would be known as right brain dominant people, creative people. And the people who give you the lists, orders, et cetera, who would work on the project right away, those are left brain dominant people. Now, what occupations attract left brain dominant people? Well, typically people in hard sciences, engineering, et cetera. You know, if you were to ask me, hey, John, you know, you need to build a bridge abutment, how big should it be? Oh, I don't know, just build it big enough so you can stick the steel in it to hold the bridge up. You know, on the other hand, you wouldn't want to have a bunch of right brain creative people like me building bridges. Thank God there are people in this world that would look this up and the physics of it and calculate the thing out and work on it right away and be diligent. Well, the point in emergency services is this. You give somebody the word, hey, I need you guys to get out there and clean that apparatus and get it detailed. Well, those right brain dominant people who are, you know, who believe in, who are visual learners and like, you know, who will put things, they'll put things off to the very last minute. And you can't say to them, well, I sort of would like you to do this. Because the people on the other side of the room who are the left brainers, they will begin working on that project right away. The problem is that in emergency services, one group thinks the other one couldn't teach a fish to swim. They just don't get along. And once you go through this exercise with people, for example, if you're going to design what an ambulance looks like, a bunch of us got together who were left brainers and did the graphics on our ambulances years ago. Well, it would take 5 minutes to read them. You know, you had so much lettering on it, it was kind of crazy. One of our EMTs was a graphic designer, and he stepped up and solicited ideas and put together a beautiful, simple design for the ambulances. Well, it's a matter of using the right people to do the right things. You know, if you're in a volunteer organization, you wouldn't want to have a right brain creative person be your treasurer. They probably aren't going to do the best job at it. You want to have that person who is,
yeah. You know, how we doing? We've got some money.
And a lot of the personality issues we get into simply have everything to do with the fact that we're just failing to appreciate that our personalities are different. Doesn't mean that we're bad EMTs and paramedics. Doesn't mean that we're bad firefighters and fire officers. But we have different personalities, and we do things differently. And we also got to have a little bit of tolerance. And the other thing I think that's really crucial about this is that every organization needs all those kinds of people in it. Because if we were all one kind of people, it would be very bad. It would be very bad. It takes all kinds. You know, a friend of mine who I've known for years, Chase Sargent, you know, talks about, well, Chase, why is it that you have spec rescue? Why do you do special ops training? Well, he goes, you know what? I'm not really good at in the construction industry. You wouldn't want me building your house for you. So I teach. Well, you know what? I'm kind of the same kind of person. You know, I'm probably not the right, you know, I'm good with building construction. I can read a building, et cetera. And don't ask me to put a bathroom in for you. I'm not your guy. You know, on the other hand, when it comes up to giving a presentation, I can do that, and I feel like I'm pretty good at it. But so you have to play to people's strengths. And I've been blessed in the organization I'm in. I have a lot of people who certainly have capabilities that I don't have. You know, for your logistics chief, for example, if you're going to select somebody to do logistics, you know, you better be selecting the right person for that. You know, don't put a right brain creative person in a job trying to manage logistics because it just won't work out for you.
Good advice. And there is, if someone wanted to go through a process of determining the different personality styles in their organization. So, you know, you got 30 people and you say, well, you got, you know, 30 people, 30 different personalities. And I can cater to the different personalities if I know what those personalities are. What you described in what you're doing in the classroom with putting them in their little groups and pods is kind of putting in them into certain personality groups. Is there something that they could do that would help identify these different personalities of their members?
Well, I know some organizations, as part of their entry process, do some psychological testing or do some screening, and I know some of them do the MMPI. For me, it was very eye-opening to ask a few basic questions and split people up into groups. I think if you have a little bit of insight and you're willing to do some reading about this, you can actually look at people and watch people and learn pretty well what kind of person they are. Doesn't mean that they're good, that they're a bad person or a good person per se. They just have a different personality. And a lot of personality clashes really come down to that. The way people think and do things is simply different than the way you do it. Mm-hmm. You know, I think provided that we stay within the lines, we color within the lines, you know, within our organization, that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's when, you know, sometimes arguments and things occur because, you know, the personality is spin out of control. We end up with a lot of battles. And then, you know, as an officer, you end up having to put your black and white striped referee jersey on and try and have a clearing of the air and a meeting of the minds to try and get people going in the direction that they need to go in.
We part of the supervisor's job is oftentimes a referee of the conflicts of other people as well. We're going to take a break. This is the Leaders Toolbox on firehouse.com. I'm Rich Gassaway, your host. We're with John Politis, the chief of the Colony EMS department in upstate New York, and we are at the Wisconsin EMS Expo in Milwaukee. We'll be back momentarily.
Radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters.
Welcome back to the Leaders Toolbox on firehouse.com. I'm your host, Rich Gassaway. Again, we're with John Politis, the chief of the Colony EMS department in upstate New York and a 30-year firefighter. And we're talking about a program that John did here at the Wisconsin EMS Expo called Supervisors Boot Camp. John, what about managing change? What are some of the challenges with that?
Well, it's huge. I heard a quote that Woodrow Wilson once said that, you know, if you don't ever want to make any enemies, don't change anything. and unfortunately, a big part of what we have to do in leadership is to change, because the pace of change in fire and EMS is a brisk pace. And it's amazing. You know, I've had some breaks in service in the volunteer fire service, and coming back after a bit of a hiatus because of kids and college and other things, I noticed a lot of change. And I just noticed that something as simple as when I had to drop out for a few years, I noticed that SCBAs didn't have brackets that locked. It was an eye-opening experience the first time that I had to try and pull the SCBA out, and I realized that there was a latch. I couldn't pull it out. It may seem really silly, but it's really a lot of things have changed. A guy that I've known for years who was a deputy chief of Phoenix Fire Department, Gary Morris, I was having a conversation with him one day, and this is back in the late 80s and early 90s about... I said, gee, Gary, how is it that you get people to take infection control precautions? Because, you know, up until the, you know, mid 80s, you know, getting blood and stuff on you was a badge of, you know, it was a badge of honor. Then we all realized, gosh, you get a disease and die from this stuff. So, and he said to me, we did a lot of work on it. We've done a lot of training, a lot of re-education. It takes 5 years. And I was stunned by what he told me. But there was also a lot of wisdom in what he said, that by the time we started to implement the training on this, in training, in re-education, and, you know, in or training and retraining and supervision and follow-up, and, you know, it actually, from the day that you start trying to do it until the day it actually people are doing it consistently, takes 5 years and a lot of emotional labor. So change is difficult, and, you know, it's often said that the only people who like change are babies with wet diapers, and I think that certainly is true. You know, I hear a lot of people say, well, gosh, I want to work in a progressive department, and I joke, no, you don't, because working in a progressive organization means that you're changing things constantly. I've been fortunate to work with some incredible people in Colony, New York, both in fire and EMS, who for a 20-year period have eaten change for breakfast, lunch, and dinner every day. But I also have to say to you that it has caused a lot of organizational stress for everyone. Because when you're changing and you're constantly doing things that are out there, often on the cutting edge of resuscitation technology, of safety, et cetera, people don't appreciate it sometimes, and sometimes you take a significant amount of ridicule. I can tell you one of those things with us was we realized that, you know, when it came to multiple casualty incident management, you know, when the big one hits, you only do what you do every day. You know, if what you do every day is to speak English, you can't walk around one day in a year and say, speak French. That if we wanted to be good at managing multiple casualty incidents, we had to start implementing triaging vests. We had to start implementing things in a daily practice. And for quite a while, our neighboring organizations would look at us kind of funny, like, what are those guys doing? Why are they doing it? Isn't that stuff silly? But it began to pay off, and many of our neighbors and people in the region began to look at what we were doing and say, hey, maybe that's not such a bad idea. But when you start making change, you're really going into a bold area, because you as a leader, manager, supervisor, what have you, are really sticking your neck out. And it requires you to really think through, you know, what the issues are. I'll give you another example, infection control things. We realized that we had people sticking sharps in the squad benches of ambulances, and even though we had sharps containers in the backs, and it really was not an educational issue. We educated people. They knew what they were supposed to be doing. Unfortunately, our engineering controls were bad. We didn't put the sharps container in the ambulances anyplace even reasonably close to where they actually gained venous access. And it was a hazard for them to get up and walk with those sharps. So they did what they needed to do. Well, we moved the sharps containers, problem solved. So change is difficult. It's very stressful for people. Even when it's fairly mundane things. Such as wearing safety vests at an accident scene. So another one of the changes we implemented a number of years ago, and I had a friend of mine who was in my wedding as 32 years ago to be exact, and his name is Bill Mullady. If you actually looked up in the dictionary or encyclopedia lineman, he looked like his picture would be next to it. He worked for the power company and kind of big guys, now a supervisor with our power company in the state. And I said to him one day, "Gee, Bill, how come you're so compliant about wearing orange and safety vests and helmets?" And he said, "Well, this is a labor management issue." Both sides of the table, we realized that this is a safety issue. We're all going to be on the same page. You get caught without your safety stuff on, you get 3 days off without pay. I was kind of shocked by that. And then he said to me, "Well, look at you. You're on a highway. You can't be picking up trash on the side of the highway and adopt the highway program on Sunday mornings, you know, as a volunteer, unless you got a helmet and a safety vest on and glasses and gloves." And you know, here we are in emergency services walking around in traffic where angels fear to tread, you know, with really, really under-equipped. So we implemented this change of wearing helmets and safety vests in traffic, and a lot of people really didn't like it. But 5 years later, I'm pretty impressed at how compliant people are. If they don't have something on, it's usually a pretty good reason why they don't. But I also have to say that it caused quite a bit of stress along the way. That's just one of many changes. One of the changes I could tell you about is we went from the LifePak 10 to the LifePak 12. We went from a simple, you know, kick the tires, light the fire defibrillator, which was pretty easy, to a sophisticated, monitoring device, which really does many different things. And the cultural change that was involved in that was incredible. It was absolutely incredible. We because of declining volunteerism, we had to hire EMT staff, which we had never done before. We'd always had paid paramedics, a lot of extra paid paramedics and some volunteers. It was a huge change, a huge amount of organizational stress and personal stress for everyone in making that change. You have to do the best you can to try and educate people about it, you know, prepare people, involve people in the change as much as you possibly can. But there are times when you have to make a change and you really don't have an option, particularly as a chief officer. Somebody comes along and says, "Hey, you have to have physicals for everybody, and everybody's got to pass a respirator clearance physical." Now, you can't have a committee meeting about that and get consensus. It's essentially an OSHA issue, and you've got to implement it, along with a lot of the general duty safety things that come up. So, you know, change is difficult, and it takes a lot of work with your staff to really get people doing what they need to do.
I think one of the areas that especially new supervisors get frustrated with is they think if they find something that needs to change, they think if they tell somebody one time you need to change this, that somehow that's going to make a change in behavior. And really what a lot of times is happening is people reverting back to doing things that are habit, you know, that they had done. You do something a similar way for 10 years or 20 years, and then along comes somebody and says you need to do it in a different way. Because they tell you one time doesn't mean your behavior is going to change instantly and overnight. You know, sometimes people fall back to their old habits and their old ways of doing things. It doesn't necessarily mean they're against the change. It's just that one of the things working not in their favor is they've got memory of old ways of doing things that sometimes come up and take over and make them do that.
Rich, that is an excellent point. You know, years ago, I was going through American Heart Association CPR instructor training, and somebody made that point about muscle memory, that's like write A on a blackboard. And he come along with a very fine colored chalk and write in B over the top of that. So we're going through, we've done CPR, we've done whatever it is, the same way for a long time. What's very much imprinted in your brain is A. And that B that you want to change to is only a very fine line over the top of that. And it takes a lot of drill, a lot of practice, a lot of overlearning, a lot of re-education to get people to that change. It's tough. It's very, very tough. And I'm also guilty as charged of making the mistake of putting a memo out saying, hey, we need to do this. And, you know, people just not getting it, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, I really feel I've been, and I knew you feel the same way, I'm really honored to have worked for the years I have in emergency services with some incredible people, just incredible people that you know, I stand in awe of, and I've learned so much from. And also a difficult thing as a manager earlier on, I probably did a lot more talking than listening. And one of the things that you know, I'm at the stage of my life now, I'm in my 50s, that, you know, I realize that, you know, there's a lot to be learned by everybody. And if we just take some time to listen.
Well, for the young supervisors out there, remember that when you're trying to create and implement change, that it's a marathon, not a sprint. And that the process of creating change in your organization sometimes just takes your patience and your diligence and your understanding that you might be trying to change something that has been decades becoming the way that it is. And you get promoted and you think, well, this has got to change. Well, if it's been decades in the coming, it's probably not going to change overnight. Like John said, you know, in his organizations and some of the things that he's seen supervisors change, it can take them 5 years to get those changes well established and well implemented. I had the opportunity to talk to a safety person at a major airline about their implementation of a process called crew resource management, or cockpit resource management is what they called it in airline industry. And when he was telling us about how how they've implemented the cockpit resource management into the airline industry, one of the people that were with me, Rick Klein, asked him, well, how long did it take for you to get this to where you would say it was culturally accepted as a practice? And he said 10 years. Wow. It took them in this airline. Now, you know, they're dealing with 30,000 pilots, so, you know, it's a bigger organization. But he said it took them 10 years to where they could say that cockpit resource management was a cultural change in their philosophy about safety in the airline. So, you know, if we can get it done in 5 years, we're 5 years ahead of where the airline industry was with getting cockpit resource management change implemented. John, why is this opportunity of being an officer so important about, you know, making a difference in an organization?
Well, a couple of things. I think, you know, I was doing a talk in New Hampshire at the New Hampshire Fire Academy. One of my colleagues and known for a long time is Sue Prentice, who's the state EMS director in New Hampshire. And also Sue Prentice and Rick Mason had me come up to do some training for fire instructors. And after I finished one of the presentations, I had a young company officer from one of the paid departments come up to me and say, you know, I'm working really hard at this, but, man, the people that I work with, they just don't, at times, I'm really frustrated because they don't seem to be following my lead and doing what I would like them to do. And what I said to him was, you know, you need to keep doing what you're doing. And I related to him a story about with my son. My son Ian, I was teaching him how to drive, and he made a turn which he shouldn't have made and kind of did something. And I kind of barked at him and said, Ian, you need to stop that right now. And I could tell he was kind of upset with me. And we got back to the house and we got in the house, and my son basically gave me a tongue lashing after he parked the car, saying, remember when we were little kids? You said never to holler when you were driving a car because it startles you and it could get into an accident. Well, that's what you just did to me.
Yeah, yeah.
In a nanosecond, I realized that, you know what, all those times that I didn't think my son was watching or paying attention to what I was saying and doing, he was really watching and paying attention to what I was saying and doing. And thinking back to all of my years in this, as many of you listening to this, and you, Rich, and everybody, you know, we all watch what people do. And that company officer I talked to was a really nice guy. We talked for a while, and he said, you know, I understand what you're saying. You know, people really do watch what you do, and they'll pay attention to what you do. I guess, you know, one of the things we talk about in the class is, you know, do you remember who the last Miss USA was? Eh, most people can't remember that. You know, who was the MVP in the last Super Bowl? Usually some people in the class can remember that. And, all right, last year, you know, for 2008, who won the Academy Award for Best Picture or Best Actor or Actress? And you can't remember that. Anyway, they asked people, can you remember three teachers that made a difference to you? And I think everybody can remember three teachers that made a difference. Can you name three people in EMS who were your mentors, who were your teachers, and people who showed you the way? You know, who was a friend that was there for you when you needed them the most? You may never be famous, but you'll have an opportunity to make a difference in the lives of many people. I have two friends from Vermont who, from the Rutland City Fire Department, who I think were just remarkable people. And I went to college in Vermont and was a call man for the Rutland City Fire Department. And two guys that I was really close with, who we kind of grew up together, and they were both, you know, were both union presidents at various points in time and went on. One of his name's Mike Walsh, and the other one, Gary Gregorio. And Mike tragically passed away from lung cancer at the end of the year in 2008 or early 2009. I was invited up to go to Gary Gregorio's retirement party by Mike and the other guys who were part of the union. And going to Gary's retirement party, Gary rose to the rank of deputy chief also, and was one of the two deputy chiefs. You know, Gary his son is a firefighter in Cincinnati, and Gary has moved from Rutland, Vermont out to Cincinnati to be near his son. Just had a love for the fire service, and going to Gary's party really brought this really into focus that both Gary and Mike, two guys that really mentored me as a firefighter, and really watched my backside and protected me. And I worked with them on EMS things because I was an EMS guy, and I ran EMT classes, and I worked with those two guys to help start the paramedic program in the Rutland Fire Department after I'd left Vermont to go to Albany to run the paramedic program. But his retirement party, you couldn't get in the place because there were so many people, because Gary and Mike and guys respected them so much. They walked a really important line between being a buddy and being a boss. They were excellent role models. They were firefighters. They were paramedics. They did the job, no bull. And I also might add, and anybody who was listening to this who knows either of these two guys, you know, neither one of them suffered fools very well, which you know, I have to chuckle about it. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, I think anybody who knew either one of these guys would say, you know what, they made a difference in the lives of a lot of people. They rose to the ranks. They took leadership. At first, they took leadership in their union, and they did a really good job with that. Then they took leadership in the department as being officers, and then they rose up to the ranks of being deputy chief. You know, and I think every one of us can identify somebody, not just somebody, many people in our careers who made a huge difference to us in helping to bring us along, in helping to bring organizations along and do things. Those two guys single-handedly brought the first paramedic program to the state of Vermont. I helped them with that because I was running a paramedic training program. Those two guys, because of their experience and the things that they had done and the leadership that they provided and how they stuck their neck out, really blazed the way, along with a lot of other guys in the department as well, I might add. I'm not saying it was a singular effort. It was a team effort. But we all know people who make a difference. And I think taking the step, going from buddy to boss, going for the gold, makes a huge difference. And you can make a difference, and you may not ever be famous. You know, you're probably not going to be famous on television, but you know what? In the lives of people that matter, you know, when you think about who are the people that matter to you in your life, they made a big difference to the people that matter in their lives. And that, to me, is really what this is all about. It's really what leadership is all about.
You know, I had read a quote, and I will close it out here. that said, "You mean the world to somebody, act accordingly." You know, and yeah. And for a lot of the people who we supervise, we are the role models that they look up to,
yeah.
And that's how they learn how to be good supervisors, is by our examples. And supervisory roles, every day we're planting seeds that are going to turn into a wonderful crop or some terrible weeds. And our behavior determines the amount of rain and sunshine that those seeds are going to get, and how things turn out in the examples that we set. John, you've shared some tremendous wisdom. The Supervisors Boot Camp sounds like a fabulous program. We're going to put a link at the bottom of the player page to information about your company and the how they can reach you if they're interested in hosting a program, because I think this is the bread and butter of how to be a good frontline, down and dirty supervisor, and with good advice about how to be successful. So I want to thank you, John Politis, the chief of Colony Fire and EMS.
Just Colony EMS.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm sorry, John. Yeah, Colony EMS and Verdoy Fire Department, with 21 years in EMS and 30 years in the fire department. Yeah, I don't want to misspeak there and cause some problems with the folks in Colony. But it was really a pleasure to sit down with you. Thank you for the gift of your time. I know you spent today teaching another class, and it's the end of the day. It's dinner time now, and we're tired, and I appreciate the gift that you've given to the listeners.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this with you, Rich.
Okay. Well, until next time, this is Leaders Toolbox on Firehouse.com. Be safe. Make good decisions.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.